We will now have the question and answers. I invite you to come up to this mic, since this is the recording portion of the mics. I will be standing on at the other mic and asking you to cut it short if your preamble becomes too long, and keep your questions to maybe two at the most. I'd like you to welcome Paul back up to the stage now. And I'd like to ask the first question, if I may. Paul, could you comment on the fact that some members of the who was running for office stated that unless you vote me in, you won't have a voice in government? Could you comment on that, please?
How many minutes do I have? I think one of the saddest things with democracy is when the people in power realize that they can divide and conquer, and then that becomes their goal, is how do I divide and conquer? And we could look in a room like this today and ask, you know, does the majority rule? Who's in favor that majority rules? And have a show of hands. Should majority rule? I don't know that we got a majority yet. But then if I'm a great, what would I say, not a great leader, but a leader who wants to have power and give you something, and then say, well, the next vote is that we're going to say that those over 50 get a free lunch and those under 50 have to pay for it. And let's vote. And just looking around, I think there's a few of us that are going to...
That's okay.
But what that is that's a divide and conquer. And I promised you, if I went around and polled you earlier, and I knew that the demographics, what they were going to be, I could pass that, and I'd get the majority of people voting for me. And this is what I believe is a major struggle with democracy, is that we need to change that. And that was the number one thing that I heard negative when I went door to door. Paul, we love your work. We love your honesty, your representation. You got good ideas, but we can't afford to vote for you because we've been told on no uncertain circumstances that the money will not be coming to our riding if we elect you again. And I got that from many people, from elected people, people on museum boards, library boards, and the message was went out there. And that was my struggle, I felt, in the campaign, because we're hurting. All of our municipalities are underfunded, don't have enough money. And I would like to see, and that's another, I guess I should put on my democratic reform, is I believe in funding formulas, not arbitrary political decisions on money coming to different areas. And I just want to comment, and I'll use the health as an example. I'm just appalled to think that we're going to centralize and even consider going to three health boards. It's centralization and control is already a struggle. One health board, yes, you're right. But we look at that and the problem and what I feel it is, and I love our public system. But like I say, I am a free entrepreneur. I'd love someone to be able to come in and do something else if they want. But even here in Lethbridge, we would have had cancer treatment years ago. We would have had an MRI long before we did, wouldn't have had to raise the money. There's so many things that if it was a per capita funding, you know, we'd have an angioplasty surgeon that wants to come back from the States. How many people know Dr. Steed, who's the head of the MRI? Do you know where we got him from? He came from Eugene, Oregon, but you know where he was born and raised, don't you? Lethbridge. Left of the States, but we got him back. But there's many people that want to come back, but because of the way the funding is, and like I say, for heart surgery and angioplasty surgery, they say that, and I asked Minister Evans at this and got the letter back saying, well, we can't afford, it's $11,000 per surgery, we can't afford it to go to Lethbridge. We centralize all of that money in Calgary and Edmonton. Well, we could and we should have one, but it again goes back to arbitrary political decisions instead of what I want to call is per capita funding being the base of the area. But sorry for such a long answer on that. But like I say, I could speak the rest of the day.
You're right. From here, excuse me.
Henning Lindell is my name, Paul. And
I thought I was.
I'll stand here then, so you can...
Okay. Henning Lindell is my name. And Paul, I wanted to ask you, you outlined a system of voting sort of with two votes, but I wonder if you could share your perspective on proportional representation.
I haven't dove into that as much as a lot of areas, and even like D.C. when they went through their citizens initiative and did their two-year study on that. The problem that I have with proportional representation, to my understanding, is that, for example, in this last election, then would I be the one from the Wild Rose Alliance that got in? How do you decide which person goes in and represents, and who am I really accountable to? The people across the province? And I believe in being held accountable. That's why I like the recall. And that's where I think just the 50% plus one past the post is much more understandable and not so confusing. And like I say, the representation that I've looked at, I just don't see how you decide. You know, we got 7% of the vote this time. Who are the five that are going to be the Wild Rose Alliance MLAs? Who are the two green MLAs? Who, you know, and I don't have a system in my mind, nor have anybody show it to me and say, this is how it would work, and then you're held accountable. And so that's why I tend to go this other way, and I love the 50% plus one past the post, because you go down and you can say, yes, but Ed Stelmach got in that way and others. But we would sophisticate our voting and become wiser as time went forward, I believe. I hope that answers your question.
Hi, my name is Roberto DeSandoli. And I was just wondering, going from the topic of proportionate representation, the mixed member plurality system used in, I think, several countries in Europe where there's lists for Germany as well, candidates who are locally elected and candidates who are from the party lists, where there's still local, sort of a hybrid between local representation and proportionate representation. I'm just wondering, with there's sort of a strange catch-22 with proportional representation in Alberta, and that is that with the establishment the way it is, they have no reason to change their minds about using a first-past-the-post or single transferable vote. And obviously we can't hope for any electoral reform until we get a different establishment in, and we can't get a different establishment in until we get proportional representation in. So I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you, well, how do you fix that? But I was just wondering if you could maybe comment on that a little bit.
Well, thank you. And I look at some of those countries like Germany and whatnot, and I don't know that their democracy is working any better than ours. But what it involves, in my opinion, is first of all, I always say, you know, follow the money. And that's what I say, it was a major problem for myself or other ones. But if that funding is coming to the caucus and they can spread their message, I think we'll have a huge leap forward in our democratic discussions that go on. And what I've looked at representation by population and then representation by vote, I just don't see the accountability. And I'm one of these guys, I like the KISP principle. Keep it simple, please. And I like it that way. People can understand it. That's a politically correct version of the KISS. We want to engage them, and it's understandable, and so that's what I'd hope.
Hello, my name is James Moore. Paul, I'd like to ask you to comment on something that I saw in yesterday's Calgary Herald. It was reported that in the legislature, a Liberal member questioned Mr. Stelmach's $25 million propaganda campaign to convince the world that the tar sands are green. And what really disturbed me is that Mr. Stelmach called him a subversive. I mean, to me, this goes back to the divine right of kings, and if you criticize the king, off with your head. It's pretty dangerous territory, I think, in a democracy. And I'd just like you to comment on that, please.
Thanks, James. That's a tough question. One of the things that I found most discouraging sitting in the legislature is, well, I guess I want to call the radicalism that can appear on both sides. And I think that integrity and honesty should always be the top priority. And I'll go back to one of the times when I was reprimanded and had to apologize. The premier came down to my riding and raised money at a golf tournament in my riding, and I was calling him to task on that, and that's not an honorable thing to do, and I had to step back on it. And I think, first of all, we need to be accurate, make sure that what we're doing is right, and to have the tolerance and belief that other people have different views. But what I want to call the bullying that goes on in the legislature is unacceptable to me. There was three members that I felt that we struggled really hard to stay above it, David Swan and Wesleyan Mather. And I have a great deal of respect for them that we need to do that. But we need to be politically correct in making our allegations. But I think it's much more better to have an open discussion and say, this is why I think we shouldn't do this. But no, the real problem that you're talking about is the political propaganda that this government can spend our money on to so-called inform the public or misinform the public that costs us so dearly in the mistakes we make, whether it's medical, environmental, energy, all of those areas. We don't have an informed public that understands. We have more that are feared or that just, you know, don't know. And many times when I got in the debate in the legislature and I talked to some of those other MLAs, that the information packet that they received on their briefing is just a joke, in my opinion. Well, where are you getting your information from, Paul? I said, I'm working darn hard at night to get it. You should too. Because they're just puppets that are given the information. So, well, I had no idea that was even out there. And I mean, there's just so many things, James, that we don't have an informed discussion on, and it's just vote. You're in line, the whip is there, and do it. And no, the government, and that's why I say I want those groups that want to be able to put out that advertisement that aren't impressed with Stelmac, they should have the right to do it and not have new political laws that say you can't do that as a group to come together and put in those ads. We need to be able to have the freedom of information and the freedom to speak and to challenge those things. But I hope that answers your question in a roundabout way.
My name's Ed Bardock. In the history of this province, change has come from the right. Lougheed took out the Social Credit Party, but it still was a conservative party. Klein took out the Getty Red Tories, but it still was a conservative party. 2 weeks ago, if I understand the press release correctly, David Swan said that what is needed in Alberta is a change in names, and he talked about the Liberal government or the Liberal Party. To my mind, a dandelion is still a dandelion if someone wants to call it a carnation. What's your reaction to a simple name change to effect change in this province? I don't think it'll go anywhere.
I believe in the provincial debate, I made the comment that we changed the head, but we didn't change the beast with the premier. And it's the same. The Liberals have had over $1 million for the last 3 years to develop their policy, to get their message out. They had 16 MLAs. They had a great opportunity. And I think, personally, myself, they need to step back, retrospect, and say, are we really in touch with Albertans? Because they had the opportunity. Never was the opportunity better than this time, because Albertans wanted change, but they did not see, they went shopping, and they did not see anything they wanted to buy, in my opinion. And as I say, where we got hurt, I felt, as the Alliance, was that he says, if you vote for the Alliance, you vote for the Liberal. And that was just the final nail in our casket, in my opinion, because what he did, he lumped them all together. You're for us or against us, and you do anything else, it's going to be against us. But I believe that's why you say that the right shall prevail.
Your turn, John. John Boris. Paul, I'm pleased to see that you see cracks in what the Liberals are doing or what the PCers are doing. The last speaker, I think, spoke about having a different name. Am I not right? If you look at the history of the process in Canada, you'll find that they are pretty well all double-barreled parties. They have to pay some dues to the older parties that were there. The PCs were not PCs till 48, 49, I don't know when it was, leadership, and they had a vote. And this doctor that led them, in the end, accepted the fact that he would call it progressive conservative. You go to Europe and you try and set up a new party, you will more than likely find more of them being called white, black, purple, green. They put on the other opposition. And they do it because it gives them a little bit of stature, because they say, well, look, I can give you this. This isn't very much, but I can do something. But if you try and change it, there are people that would rather go to jail, I think, than be called a Liberal. See? Well, the question, why don't we just work on proportional representation, which works in pretty well all of Europe. It's working in 5 provinces in Canada. And I think that's the way to go, because you have to pay some heed to these people that have done a job regardless of how you and I may look at it. Would you care to come up and... Oh, you don't... Okay.
I can respect that, and Democratic, let's go out and work on Democratic reform. I laid out the ones that I feel that I've studied and I think would do a better job. And I always go back, it goes back to the funding. And if people know that their vote is going to fund what they believe in, I believe they'll engage much more. And I guess I go back with, as the Alliance guy, I'm very much believe that we don't really hardly even need parties in the legislature or anywhere, just like municipal government, but we need is good representation that vote on their conscience, and that then would represent it. And the only time you need the so-called whip is in a confidence vote or a money bill, I feel, and the rest of the time that it could very easily be a Democratic vote. I mean, they had so few votes that they said, where you saw them vote against it. The smoking bill was one where a few of the rural MLAs got up and voted against, what they were doing. But we just need free votes that are really free. And again, the accountability back to the area you represent would be a huge step forward, I believe, in democracy and people actually voting for a person to represent them rather than a party of unknown agendas.
My name is Lisa Lambert. I have a clarification and then a question. The clarification is just about something Mr. Boris said. He mentioned that there was 5 provinces doing PR, and that they have not passed PR. I just wanted to clarify that. There are 5 provinces that are investigating PR, and none of those have passed in any of the... So we're
80% bar is what stopped it.
Yeah, but we're not using a PR system anywhere in Canada. We just have to be clear about that. I'm a big fan of PR. So. I am a student of campaign finance reform, did my master's degree on it. So one of the things that I think is perhaps missing in what you're talking about, along with the proportional funding, you didn't call it proportional, I think you called it weighted funding, but the proportional funding, there has to be a secondary side to that, and that is control over donations. Unless there's control over who donates and how much they donate, and how much has to be given, how much information is given out about that, you have a system like we have in Alberta, which is remarkably corrupt, and yet we can't find out anything about the people who have donated to the Progressive Conservative Party. They are beholden to a number of corporations. At the federal level, we have limited donations now to people. Only people can donate, because only people can vote. It only makes sense. So my question to you is, why not bring in as another one of the democratic reforms that you're talking about, controls on who can donate so that corporations and unions cannot donate to political parties, and those donations can only come from people who vote.
Excellent question and point, Lisa, and I'll share my thought on it. That first of all, a lot of the great progression in the world have come from individuals. I think one of the greatest things that we're going to see here in the next few years is from Bill Gates and his multi-billion-dollar effort to solve the problems in Africa. And I wanted to compare philanthropy and democracy together, is that it takes great individuals with great money and to do that. And so I never want to put the controls in to say someone can't affect this. But what I do want is open and honesty. And what that is that the donations are there. And you see exactly who's donating. But a lot of people donate with no strings attached, but because they believe what you're saying. They believe in those policies, those principles, and they want to see you promote it. When you see the donations that came to the Alberta Alliance, I met with a lot of very wealthy individuals prior to the election, but the very first thing up front was they knew that there was no loyalty. These are the principles we're standing on, and frankly, my own opinion that, yes, if you say it can't happen openly, it just happens closed behind closed doors, and there's perks and policies and things that come out anyways, and you can never eliminate that unless you eliminate money, in my opinion, and we don't live in that type of society. There's always going to be benefits or perks or something that happen, and it just gets buried deeper and deeper. I want open. I want the numbers there, and if someone wanted to donate $1 million to the Liberals, the Green, or the Alliance, I think it should be a fine thing to do and allow that, because it is great individuals who have a vision, who see something that needs to change, and it is so hard to get it done. But let's be honest and open. We know that you know what Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are doing for Africa, and we know the dollars. It's open and honesty that's more important to me than to say that, oh, you're limited, you're wealthy, but we're not going to let you use your money to improve democracy. And everything has a good and bad use, and that includes money.
Paul, thanks for your presentation. With the consistently low voter turnout, I wonder whether you have a position on compulsory voting. I gather it's worked. It's been functioning in Australia for 30, 40 years, and they have a 95% turnout. What is your position, if you have one, on compulsory voting?
Well, I'm older. I don't know if I'm wiser. But 4 years ago, if you'd have asked me that, Trevor, I'd say absolutely we should have mandatory voting, and there should be a fine just like mandatory seat belts. I've changed my mind since being in government, and I went from should be mandatory to should be rewarded with a $100 tax credit that's going to show up on your Alberta tax to to the point where, no, I want people to get out and vote because they want to. And I just believe in freedom, and like I say, I've evolved over that. Whether I'm wiser on it, I don't know, but I want people to be inspired, to be enthused behind a movement and be involved, because the number of people that will come out and vote, it worries me that we might get even a worse and a more negative one. And again, Australia's been doing it forever, and we can always make small changes, but to just go out and say next time Albertans have to vote or there's going to be a $5,000 fine, might not be a fine election in my mind. It might be a real disaster in what we get into. I'm taking it extreme, but anyways, that's my thought over the years, is that I want people to be inspired to vote, not required.
Michael Cormican here. Glad to hear you saying that last thing there about rewarding rather than penalizing. I don't like penalizing. And I got to compliment you for that. The Alberta government only a couple of years ago gave out $400 to every man, woman, and child, many of them even outside of the country. I don't see why they could very easily factor that in, and it becomes an established fact, and it rewards those, and I'm sure it would entice an increase in the number coming out to vote. That would be my comment on it. That's why I kind of hooted a bit there on that for you. Sorry, as I said, I didn't really have a question formulated in my head because a couple of people already stole them on me, got up before me.
I'll comment on that.
Sure, yeah.
Again, the enticement, and I love the philosophy, tax more what you want less of and less what you want more of. And I think that quite often works to our benefit. But the enticing, I mean, that's what I find the biggest problem with democracy is the buying of votes. And I look at most, so many of their political programs are nothing but political slush funds to me to buy votes. And the classic one to me is the Rural Initiative Program, $100 million. I go back to the BSE crisis in Pincher Creek. Premier Klein and Dave Coutts went out to that group of individuals trying to put a killing plant in place. And as they were leaving, so I was told by Ken, I believe it was Ken Lewis who told me, but I shouldn't be quoting this. But anyways, long story short, the one turned to the other and says, you know, we should be able to do that. $25 million, a package, that would be a great, great project, wouldn't it? And those people that I talked to says, we can't afford, this goes back to the same problem, we can't afford to vote for someone else. We need our packing plant. And they said they could get us $25 million. The Rural Initiative Program to me, and also the new Community Spirit Program, is nothing more than buying support for the party. If there's something great you want here in Lethbridge, come to us and we will match your money that you raise with other people's money, so vote for us. And so whenever that enticing there, I think that's even a greater, a walk on the dark side when we have those enticements. Let's make it universal. And like I say, just let's be inspired to go out and vote, not that, oh, I'm going to get $50. And as far as the $400, what I was pushing for very hard back then is that I believe Albertans are overtaxed. I believe our entrepreneurial spirit isn't even close to touching what it could be because of the taxes that we pay. And it takes money and wealth and ingenuity to step forward. And if we would allow that money to stay in our pockets, we'd put it to much better use. And something else that I wanted to touch quickly on, and I didn't, but one of the things that took me a long time to get was the taxation that left our communities. And I got finally from 2005, but the city of Lethbridge paid federally $218 million in federal tax. They paid $90 million to the province, but what's interesting is charitable donations from the people of Lethbridge, $31 million. And as you go through the list and you see what different areas donate, if the taxes weren't there, and you know whether we want to raise money, you know, for cancer treatment here in Lethbridge or whatever else, if the money stayed here and we didn't tax so heavy, I believe that Lethbridge would do what Lethbridge needs to do. We're overtaxed. We're dependent on the provincial and federal government for everything we want to do, but yet they're dependent on our money from our area. And when you go through the numbers of what leaves a community, and small communities like Coop say, oh, we could never survive. But if we were to set it, and this is another one of the democratic reform to like to see, when I talk about a formula instead of, you know, arbitrary funding, it's much like our income tax. If the first $20,000, which I think it should be minimum, was tax-free to Canadians, they'd be able to help themselves more. But when you start paying at $9,000 and you're paying tax, I mean, they already can't make ends meet. They're dependent on the government for programs. And what we need is the same for communities, that first money that's paid to the province and the federal government, whether it's $200,000, $500,000, if that stayed in the community, communities would thrive and they would go forward. But when you look at the fiscal imbalance and what leaves our communities, we're in sad shape. We do them remarkably well for the money that leaves. I'll give you one other example, Tabor, $25 million federal income tax paid, $10 million provincial, donations, charitable organizations, $4 million. people want to look after their communities, they will, but we need the money to stay here and to have it all sent out and then have to go, for example, in Tabor, our struggle to get a woman's shelter to get funded was tremendous. They finally got recognition and got funding, but the money was there. I mean, the town gave them the land, construction people donated to build the building, and if we had more money in our communities or a program that sent it back, we'd do much better. And I always said I'd like to start and return 10% of the corporate and personal income tax back to the community where it was taken from. It would change democracy in Alberta and Canada, I believe.
Last question before
you go. Hi, my name is Bev Mendel-Atherstone. Thank you very much. It sounds like it's been quite a hard road being in the legislature and then being voted out. I want to thank you for your candor and for sharing with us a lot of things that we thought were going on, but we didn't have the data. I guess on that point, I'm very concerned about what you were mentioning about the MLAs not getting information and then going in and voting on our behalf in the legislature. What do you feel is the best way that we can get this kind of information out to the voters? And how do you feel that our MLAs, that we can help our MLAs to have access to what is really happening and how we want them to vote?
Well, that's another excellent question, Bev, and I appreciate that your effort in democracy and things that you've done in the past. You know, information is critical. It's always the misinformation. All of my mistakes in life, the biggest ones, have said, oh, if I only knew that 2 years ago. And it's the same in there. I'd sum it up, first of all, saying the best bang for the taxpayers' dollars is in opposition representation. The opposition works incredibly hard at being what I want to call the inspector, checking things over, looking for better ways. In government, they're far too complacent. We don't want to make these drastic moves or these changes, and it's hard to implement it, even though they might have lots of great ideas. It just doesn't move up through the system. But we need to, again, I guess I would go back and say we need to educate our students better, that we do not teach our kids enough in high school and elementary school the precious value that freedom and democracy is, and we don't understand it well enough, in my opinion. I love, you know, the saying artis liberalis, the freedom arts, the arts that make us free. And you talk about changing names and everything else. I really feel like we've changed the whole meaning of what liberal is and what conservative is and all of those things, and it's all part of the confusion. You know, that Engels and Karl talked about changing, you know, don't just change the meaning of the word and confuse people. And so many of the young people and everything else, that they're confused, they don't know what things stand for, and it just goes back to education, I believe. Do we understand? What is freedom? How precious is it? What's the weight of the individual versus society? And I believe that the individual needs to come first, in accountability and in those things, and the society comes second, and then the basic philosophy, you know, is government the answer? Many people believe that government is, and I don't. I think that government's job is first and foremost to protect our freedoms, our life, our freedom and our property, and not to protect us from ourselves. And too often we get conned into this idea that, you know, I'm going to help you, I'll protect you, I'll give you this, and we vote for it. And I compare government often to the lottery, that everybody goes in there with high hopes, but the reality is we come out with far less than what goes in, and you got some fat cats that skim it off of there. And when you ask government to solve a problem, they'll probably exacerbate the problem, and we struggle with it for years more. We need more freedom and accountability. Our legal system isn't working. We need a justice system, one that realizes that you have to restore what damages you've been doing. But there's just so many things. I love government. I love the discussion of government. I love the discussion on what we need to do to solve it. And we just need to do more of that, I believe. And let's educate our kids better. Let's realize what precious freedoms we have and what we can aspire to do with those freedoms, rather than continue to take them away, continue to centralize government and to centralize the money and the authority. But thank you very much for having me here. I need to correct. It's 40 years. My math is terrible. 67. But anyways, congratulations. Keep it up. And let's keep discussing our problems.
Thank you very much, Paul. That was inspiring. Please join us next week for tasers. It's a hot topic, literally. Thanks for today. Enjoy the weekend. It's summertime out there.